Thank you very much for coming. I'm going to try to address three issues here. First of all, because I would assume not all of you live and die and focus on climate geoengineering, I'm going to give you a brief overview of the concept itself. Second of all, talk about the treatment of climate geoengineering in this fifth assessment report across the three working groups that looked at this issue in this context. And then finally, talk about some of the things that weren't really addressed in the IPCC reports very briefly. So first of all, a very brief overview of what we mean when we talk about climate geoengineering. And the best place to start is a working definition. This is from the National Academy of Science. So options involving large-scale engineering of the environment in order to combat or counteract the effects of climate change. Climate changes in atmospheric chemistry, and virtually all definitions use these key concepts: large scale, some kind of geoengineering architecture, and efforts to address potential climactic impacts associated with anthropogenic climate change. In most cases, climate geoengineering is contrasted with two other approaches to addressing climate change, and those are mitigation and adaptation, and these are definitions from the IPCC again. Mitigation, again, is an anthropogenic or man-generated intervention to reduce the sources or enhance the sinks of greenhouse gases. And sinks are things that can store greenhouse gases, most prominently carbon dioxide. And that adaptation is adjustments in either human institutions or ecosystems to either live with the impacts of climate change that we must live with, or to try to gain some advantages associated with those changes. One of the things to emphasize is that the IPCC has indicated that some climate geoengineering approaches in some ways blend with mitigation approaches, in the sense that there's an emphasis in some of them on trying to enhance sinks and facilitate efforts to take in more carbon dioxide. So the lines between these different concepts aren't necessarily as clear as they might initially appear to be. In the field of climate geoengineering, we generally look at two broad categories of options that could be utilized. And those categories are what we call solar radiation management approaches and carbon dioxide removal approaches. Solar radiation efforts attempt to deflect some of the incoming solar radiation back out into space. If that radiation doesn't reach Earth's surface and seek to escape again and be trapped by the greenhouse gases that absorb them, then it exerts a cooling impact. Okay. The second approach is carbon dioxide removal, and that is it gets at the source of radiative forcing. It seeks to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases, most notably carbon dioxide, that are in the atmosphere. As a consequence, there's less carbon dioxide to trap outgoing radiation, and again, it can exert a cooling impact. And so the technologies we look at broadly fall into these two categories, and we'll look at how the IPCC now looks at those. Climate geoengineering was notably addressed in all three of the working groups of the Intergovernmental Panel's fifth assessment report, across a fairly broad spectrum of issues, looking at potential impacts, their rationale, even to some degree the ethics of using climate geoengineering were looked at by the scientists. And in the third working group, the IPCC outlined three rationale on why the society might seek to pursue climate geoengineering approaches. The first of these is what I would call the emergency approach. Okay, humanity could end up in a situation where deploying geoengineering, particularly solar radiation approaches, appears as a lesser evil than unmitigated climate change. This is a scenario in which you have a climate change gone wild, essentially rapid melting of the ice caps, rapid sea level rise, et cetera. And the argument is that solar radiation management approaches, which can quickly reduce climactic impacts, might be utilized as a way to ameliorate some of these impacts that we're looking at. The second rationale is what I would call the economic rationale. It would be cheaper to address climate impacts through geoengineering than it would through mitigation or adaptation approaches. Okay, some estimates, for example, for solar radiation management indicate that the cost could be a 1/10th as much as seeking to mitigate emissions under most scenarios. And then the third potential rationale is what I would call the stabilization approach, which is that in order to stabilize greenhouse gases emissions in the atmosphere at a level below the threshold at which the most serious impacts will occur, and the IPCC says that's at somewhere between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius, we might use climate geoengineering approaches to ensure that we don't pass those thresholds while theoretically we work to decarbonize the world economy. And these are the approaches that the IPCC outlined and the reasons that we might use geoengineering. Now, the IPCC in the fifth assessment report embraced the categories that I talked about before, looking both at solar radiation management approaches and carbon dioxide removal approaches, with a strong bias, in my opinion, toward the carbon dioxide removal approaches. And I want to look at some of the technologies that they looked at, their assessment of those technologies, and a very brief assessment of their assessment of those technologies. So under the rubric of carbon dioxide removal approaches, first of all, the working groups looked at something called ocean fertilization. Ocean fertilization is an approach that seeks to stimulate the production of marine phytoplankton through the introduction of nutrients, most usually iron in areas that are allegedly iron deficient, but in some cases other nutrients including urea and phosphorus. And the idea is that in areas that are macronutrient rich but micronutrient poor, if you were to introduce micronutrients such as iron or urea, you would stimulate production of phytoplankton. Phytoplankton in turn would take up substantial amounts of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to utilize in the photosynthetic process. And when those organisms died, they would drop to the deep ocean and they would stay there with the carbon dioxide that they absorbed, theoretically for hundreds of years. And as a consequence, you would draw down substantially, the argument is made by proponents, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The reports of the first and third working groups of the IPCC fifth assessment observed that modeling studies estimate, however, that there's an extremely wide range of estimates of the potential for this approach, some as low as removing only 15 parts per million of atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide, which would hardly make this approach worth it given the risks, up to 100 parts per million, which would obviously be a substantial contribution to ameliorating atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide. However, they've also indicated that the field experiments that we've had to date, and this is the one area where we've actually had field experiments, about 14 of them to date, have also had wildly disparate results in terms of success or failure. The working group also briefly noted the potential risks of this approach, including downstream decreases in productivity and increased potential for increased emissions of nitrous oxide, a potent greenhouse gas that could offset all of the benefits of drawing down carbon dioxide. Notably, however, the working group failed to cite perhaps one of the most serious implications of proceeding with ocean fertilization, which is that because of the high signal-to-noise ratio, the variability that's naturally built into the system, if you were to seek to assess the effectiveness of ocean fertilization, it would have to be done at a scale and for a period of time that would be so great and so long that by the time you determine if the approach was effective, you may have irreversibly damaged ocean ecosystems. And so that concept of irreversibility is something that's important in a lot of these technologies and that the IPCC, for some reason, seemed to ignore, and is certainly a major part of the risks associated with geoengineering approaches, in my opinion. The first and third working groups also referred to an approach called enhanced ocean upwelling. And enhanced ocean upwelling essentially seeks to deploy pipes in deep ocean areas and to pump nutrient-rich waters from these deep ocean areas to surface waters. And by doing that, again, stimulate production of algae and other species that will take up carbon dioxide, drop to the bottom of the ocean and again sequester carbon. Both the first and third working groups of the IPCC noted that this approach has not been attested, however, in the field, and that the maximum potential is fairly minimal. Notably, the IPCC failed to cite several peer-reviewed studies that also indicate that the cost of deploying hundreds of millions of these pipes would probably make this a cost-prohibitive approach. And perhaps most importantly, should this technology ever fail, or should we have to cease to use it, you would get a massive, what we call rebound effect, a pulse of carbon that had built up in the interim that would be so great that it would produce warming that was greater than business as usual scenarios. So again, a high risk technology and kind of, in my opinion, an underestimation on the part of the IPCC of the potential threat that this would pose. Another technology that was looked at is what's called enhanced weathering techniques, which would attempt to accelerate the removal of carbon from the atmosphere by seeking to accelerate the drawdown of minerals during the chemical weathering of silicate rocks or other kinds of minerals. It would involve application of powdered minerals to the land or the oceans to artificially dissolve these minerals and seek to speed up the process of weathering and the uptake of carbon dioxide. The third working group's report concluded that the maximum drawdown would be approximately a gigaton of carbon annually. And the first working group indicated that it could also elevate pH in the oceans and help to counteract ocean acidification associated with carbon dioxide. However, while the third group noted that there would be a quote-unquote notable energy demand associated with this approach, this appears to be a massive understatement. Two recent peer-reviewed studies have indicated that the energy that would be required to extract these minerals would in turn produce levels of carbon dioxide that would be commensurate with the levels of carbon dioxide that would be taken up in extracting those minerals. And that again emphasizes the problematic role of some of these approaches. The first and third working groups also sought to address the potential role of what's called bioenergy and carbon capture approaches. This system is often termed a negative emissions approach because what it entails is using biomass, things such as forests, agricultural discards, organic waste, as a fuel source. After that fuel source is then combusted for energy production, it's contemplated that you would then use the carbon capture and sequestration technologies to store that carbon, resulting in negative emissions. Okay? Carbon capture and sequestration, as many of you will know, is a technology that would seek to collect the carbon dioxide, compress it, produce it in a liquid form that could be then transported and stored for long periods of time, hundreds of years, either terrestrially, underground, for example, in saline formations, or perhaps in the oceans. Okay. The impetus for this technology are several other parts of the IPCC report that indicate that at this point, that if we're not to pass critical thresholds, which they're now pegging at 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it's probably inevitable that we'll need some forms of negative emissions in the latter part of the century, or we'll assuredly pass those thresholds and they'll be irreversible on timescales of centuries. And so there's a lot of emphasis in the working group's report on this negative emissions technology. However, given the fact that this is one of the most important technologies that are focused on, I found it lamentable that there was not more emphasis on the challenges associated with using a bioenergy and a carbon capture approach. I think there's several issues associated with this. For one, it's been estimated that to draw down carbon to the levels that would be necessary not to pass critical thresholds would probably require something like 1,500 million hectares of land. Okay, it's a lot of land. Okay, and a number of recent studies, peer-reviewed studies not cited by the IPCC in the working group reports, indicate that if you were to have to draw that amount of land, a substantial portion of it would be natural grasslands, which would have serious biodiversity implications. Moreover, a recent study by Van Vuren, which is cited in the working group report, but not for this proposition, indicated that considerable parts of the areas of the world that could be used for biomass production are areas of high water scarcity. And so to utilize those lands, again, could potentially threaten the livelihoods of many in those areas who rely on that water and alter hydrologic cycles in the area. Okay, and then most importantly in some ways is the storage issue. Okay, at this point, there's currently 1 megaton of carbon dioxide that's stored in off the coast in the North Sea. Okay, by comparison, in order to realize the CCS scenarios that most proponents of this approach are talking about, we would need global storage of approximately 10,000 times what we're looking at currently. This would also require infrastructure, pipes, roads, et cetera, that would be more than double or triple the magnitude of what we use for the oil, gas, and coal industry combined. Okay. Not only does that pose tremendous costs, but as a law person, the first thought I have is NIMBY. Okay. The fact that there would be tremendous public resistance to developing all of this infrastructure and also telling people that you were going to store huge amounts of carbon dioxide under their land or in areas close to their land. Okay. We've already seen this backlash, fair or not, in areas such as Germany and the Netherlands when it comes to carbon capture and sequestration. And those were small projects compared to the magnitude that we're talking about in this context. So in terms of socioeconomic issues and in terms of logistical issues, I think one of the primary approaches was given short shrift in terms of this, in terms of these reports. Another approach is direct air capture. Direct air capture seeks to capture carbon dioxide through the use of sorbent materials, such as calcium hydroxide or silicates and amines, or to use a filtering system. Proponents argue that we could sequester enough carbon dioxide by using air capture, by the development of these artificial trees, for example, that you see on this side, to return atmospheric carbon dioxide levels to pre-industrial levels. However, as the first and third working groups note, cost estimates for this approach range from about $40 to more than $600. Moreover, the storage issues that we talked about in terms of carbon dioxide, again, would be of a huge magnitude and are not addressed, both from a political standpoint or a legal standpoint. For example, should there be leakage and damages associated with water tables or to human health or to ecosystem health. Final approach that was looked at in terms of carbon dioxide removal was something called biochar. And biochar is a process by which biomass is heated to very high temperatures in the absence of oxygen. This process then produces a high-density form of carbon, which can be used to sequester carbon dioxide in underground burial processes. The first working group noted that biochar has the technical potential to store substantial amounts of carbon over the course of this century. However, while noting that it might have adverse impacts on soil production, the working group also failed to note the potential for biochar projects to fuel huge land grabs in places such as Africa, where there have already been discussions of creating large biomass plantations for the purposes of producing biochar. The issue that must be asked is, would this result in displacement of indigenous peoples and other vulnerable people? Many of the same issues that we're talking about when we're looking at forestation projects in the context of climate change, but really writ on a much larger scale in terms of biochar. Again, the IPCC's assessment seems to be most lacking in the context of geoengineering when it comes to socioeconomic and cultural issues of this nature. Okay. The report also then looked at solar radiation management approach. And the IPC noted, as have many commentators, that in many ways the issues, both the benefits and the problems associated with solar radiation management, are the mirror image of carbon dioxide removal approaches. Carbon dioxide removal approaches would take a long time to make any impact in terms of climate. The IPCC in these report estimated that we'd really not be seeing these impacts till the latter part of the century when it comes to carbon dioxide removal approaches. SRM approaches, by contrast, can have almost immediate impacts. And we've seen this empirically in the past when Mount Pinatubo erupted. Decrease in incoming solar radiation within a year resulted in a decrease in temperatures of 0.5 degrees Celsius, which is quite a reduction. Okay, so we know that it can happen very quickly. It's also an approach the IPCC points out and then assesses that's fraught with much more risk, at least in their opinions, than the carbon dioxide removal approaches. So all three working groups in the fifth assessment, interestingly enough, addressed solar radiation management approaches. And they looked primarily at two of them. The first of these is what we call stratospheric aerosol injection. And this would result, would disperse large amounts of aerosols, maybe as much as 5 teragrams annually, including things such as liquid sulfur dioxide, into the stratosphere. These aerosols have high albedo, high reflectivity potential. And as a consequence, the idea is that in the stratosphere, it would reflect a substantial amount of incoming solar radiation back out into space, and it would exert a cooling effect. And these aerosols would be delivered either through airplanes, airships, or even some have proposed munitions. Okay, that's the first approach, solar radiation, first SRM approach. The second approach that was focused on by the IPCC is what's called cloud brightening. This would seek to disperse sulfates in the areas of low-level maritime clouds, maybe by using vessels such as this, unmanned GPS-guided vessels. This release of sulfates would result in the development of extra cloud condensation nuclei, and new water drops in these clouds. As a consequence, the clouds would become brighter, and the theory is that it would reflect more of the incoming solar radiation back out into space, again, exerting a cooling impact. The third working group concluded that studies of SRM indicated that this could either of these approaches could return conditions to an approximation of, quote-unquote, a low carbon dioxide-like state. And the emphasis here is that we wouldn't return back to the climates that we necessarily had in the past, because there's several other factors that would not be controlled by this, including precipitation, the hydrologic cycle, et cetera. But at least Earth, as it looked like when carbon dioxide was at much lower levels, would be the condition that could be exerted in terms of this impact. Unlike in the case of the carbon dioxide removal approaches, however, all three working groups unleashed a torrent of potential negative ramifications associated with SRM approaches. This includes substantially altering global hydrologic conditions, including potentially affecting precipitation and evaporation in monsoon regions, delaying recovery of the ozone layer for 30 to 50 years, reducing the effectiveness of solar power approaches. Moreover, the third working group emphasized that detection and attribution problems in field studies would necessitate deployment of a substantial fraction or full deployment of these approaches for many years before we could determine if they would work. And again, some of the implications as a consequence would be virtually irreversible in this context. And finally, the second working group raised the specter of potential international conflict associated with the negative impacts that they were talked about, and the so-called moral hazard, meaning that if the world society perceived that there was a quick fix to addressing climate change, it would be less likely to seek to substantially reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which would ultimately overwhelm the system and result in disastrous implications. In this context, I generally think that the critiques of SRM approaches were pretty thorough, though with some gaps. For example, in talking about changes in monsoon activities, they failed to cite several peer-reviewed studies that indicate that the monsoons in South Asia could be virtually shut down in some years. And these are monsoons that as many as 1 billion people rely on in terms of agricultural subsistence. We've seen after Mount Pinatubo, a volcanic event in the 1990s, the lowest stream flow of the Ganges River in history, for example. And again, that goes beyond monsoonal changes that the IPCC talked about and substantially emphasizes the risks associated with this approach. They also failed to mention several peer-reviewed studies that indicate that solar radiation management approaches could result in diebacks of tropical forests, including in the Amazon, with both feedback implications and serious biodiversity implications. And that, again, from the standpoint of looking at the risks of taking this approach, seems to be an oversight. And then finally, what wasn't discussed? Well, you can't really condemn scientists too much for not discussing governance and law issues, okay? Those of us that are law people would like to, but we realize that's not what they were seeking to do. Though there were some discussion of governance issues and ethics issues and justice issues in this approach. Among the critical issues that I think the reports raise but don't really address are the following. First of all, if we are to conduct research in the context of geoengineering in the next 10 or 20 years, at which point should regulatory oversight of that research occur? Should it occur at the lab level? Should it occur when we get to the field trial level at some scale of field trials? Who should regulate this? Should this be done at the domestic level? Should we trust those that are actually doing the testings, the government of those authorities to regulate these activities? Or do we need an international regulatory approach? And if yes, what regime would be appropriate for doing this? Oversight is a major issue. The third working group also indicated that some of the potential impacts of the SRM approaches could be ameliorated if we didn't go with full-scale deployment, if we did it mostly at the regional level or at a smaller scale. But this begs the question of how we determine, first of all, what that scale would be. Second of all, how would we ensure that everybody in the world would cooperate in staying at that scale? Suppose there were some countries that decided that they'd like the world warmer than under the scenarios that would be unfolded, or they'd like the world cooler. How would we ensure regulation and coordination of those efforts? Okay, it seems like a blithe response to simply say that this could be done. Okay, and then finally, while the IPCC discussed the ethics of these approaches in the first working group report, including notions of justice, it did not address practical questions associated with ethics. For example, should we deploy these technologies, would we need a compensation regime for those that may be adversely impacted? How would this be paid for? How would we determine causation in cases where the monsoon was shut down, given the fact that there's natural variability in the system? Would this be practical? If it wasn't practical, would it fuel potential for additional international conflicts? These are all issues that are raised by the IPCC and not totally answered, but would be critical if we ever really think about going down this path. So overall, when I look at the assessment that the IPCC has done in terms of climate change and geoengineering, I find the conclusions that they draw in terms of the potential impacts of climate change over the course of the next century extremely sobering. But I find the potential implications of deployment of most of the geoengineering approaches that we look at as equally or perhaps even more greatly sobering. And so it's important for us to continue this discussion and to expand on the work of the IPCC given the implications of going down this road in the future. Thank you.